Welcome to Fresh Thinking with Rabbi Ari Shishla, where it's you who sets the conversation. Join us for the next hour as we take a fresh look at how we think about spirituality.
All right, let's be honest, it's not exactly an hour. There's been some technical difficulties and we're getting a little bit of a late start, but you know, it's better than last week. Last week we couldn't even get to this point because I didn't have a voice. So it's good to be back on the airwaves and back with you. I hope that you're having a good week and that it's been not too cold, right? I think we were all thrown by the fact that there was snow on Monday. Exactly the kind of thing that really gets everybody excited here in Joburg. You know, the other parts of the world were speaking to an expat South African living in New York, and they were tickled pink by the fact that we were so excited for how much snow, I don't know. And they said, well, it's a lot of fun. And I said, yeah, it's a lot of fun when it's 6 hours and not 6 months. Yet another reason to stay in SA. So if you are listening in, you can join the conversation at any time. Excuse me. It's still going to be a little bit like that. So that's how the conversation works. It's not a monologue. It's an opportunity. It's an opportunity for you to engage, to ask questions, to make comments, to share insights. And there are various ways to do that. We long ago gave up on having people call in because it just really doesn't happen. But text, whoa. Yes, you definitely engage in text conversations. If you don't yet know how to do it, you can use an SMS on 34519. You could send a message via the Telegram app to 0618951019. Or where the action typically happens on social media. So you either find me or you find Chai FM on either Twitter or on Facebook. That's where you go. That's where we talk. We talk slash text. I guess it's a sign of the times. Very interesting though. We don't just talk and text, but we also become a little bit obsessed with the texting that we're doing. And maybe that's why we don't talk so much, but that would be conversation for another time. Today we're going to do something that's a little different to what we normally do, because typically what we do at Fresh Thinking is take a topic or an issue that is relevant in people's lives and try and see it from a perspective that is different and fresh, hence the name, Fresh Thinking, and from a perspective that is spiritual and meaningful and mindful and provoking. Today we're going to do something a little different, and that's because of the time of the year. We're currently in a period that the Jewish nation calls almost flippantly the 3 weeks. The reason I say that it's almost flippantly is because the original proper term for it is Bein HaMetzorim, a time of pressure, a time of constraint. And we just kind of, you know, almost dismiss it by saying the 3 weeks, as if it's purely just a measure of time. And this is a time of the year where we speak about, think about, and commemorate the loss and destruction of our two Batei Mikdash, the two temples that the Jews had in Jerusalem, as well as various other tragedies of our history. And there's a specific way that we're supposed to behave during this time of the year, and there's a specific focus that we're supposed to have during this time of the year. And a big part of that focus is, seeing as this is the time the temple was destroyed, this is a time we're supposed to actually learn more about the temple. So my first question to you is, what do you know about the two Jewish temples that stood in Jerusalem? Any interesting fact? Because we're going to find out today that learning about this is really valuable. So if you've got an interesting fact or a question about the two temples in Jerusalem, that's how we're going to kick off today's show.
This is Fresh Thinking with Rabbi Ari Shishla.
Yes, and today we're talking about the temple, the Beis HaMikdash, or the two temples that we had, first built by King Solomon, that stood for 410 years on the Temple Mount, and the next one built by Ezra and Nehemiah and the returning exiles of Babylon some less than a century later, and that one stood for 420 years with various renovations and modifications that were made particularly by the great, or I should say well-known Roman individual Herod. So this is a time of the year where we're supposed to illustrate that we're not just upset or, you know, it's something in our past. Once upon a time, we used to have a temple and kind of leave it at that. It's actually supposed to be something that we illustrate we care about and we'd want to restore. We say it every single day in our davening, in our prayers. Sheyibone Beis HaMikdash b'mehirah b'yomeinu. May it be your will, God, that you restore and rebuild our temple speedily in our days. We say it in our prayers. That Hashem we said in the benching, we said with the Shalayim Rechav Rachmim Toshuv, in the Amidah. It's a consistent prayer of ours that God should restore Jerusalem to its original glory and restore the temple, the Beis HaMikdash, to us. And so at this time of the year, that's something that we're supposed to focus on. What is the temple? How did it operate? What was its purpose? What did it look like? I know that the average person, probably because of the proliferation of information and imagery through the internet, so the average person probably does have a picture in their mind to a greater or lesser extent of what the temple looked like. Maybe you've been to the Holy Land Museum, where the Holy Land Hotel in Jerusalem, where they've got the scale model of the Second Temple. Maybe you've watched a documentary on the Beis HaMikdash, on the temple. Whatever, I just think people have some kind of a generalized idea of what the temple was all about or what it looked like. And this is a time of the year where we're supposed to clear the blur around the temple and try and understand a little bit more about what it's all about. You know, here's an interesting thing. We're told, if you have a look in the prophecies of Yechezkel, Ezekiel the prophet. So a big chunk of his prophecy is God says to Ezekiel, Hageid es b'nei Yisrael es habayis, tell the Jewish people about my home, which is of course the temple. That's what he says. Tell the Jewish people about the temple. And it's a series of prophecies that describe what the building is actually supposed to look like. Now, the reason that that's interesting is because of the historical context. We have to understand, when did Ezekiel live? Where did Ezekiel live? And that's relevant to this conversation. So picture the scene. The Babylonians sweep into Jerusalem under the command of a man called Nebuzradan. They're under the supreme command of Nebuchadnezzar, the great Babylonian emperor. And they destroy Jerusalem and they raise the Beis HaMikdash, they raise the temple to the ground, and they take the Jewish population of Israel, who had been living there already for 1,000 years, they take them captive. Literally, you know, the famous by the rivers of Babylon and the book of Eicha, the lamentations of the prophet Jeremiah, who was an eyewitness to this whole experience. It's a very, very heavy period in Jewish history. The first time since the Jews left Egypt that they were not in their land. I mean, obviously, there were 40 years of traveling in the desert, but from when they crossed the Jordan River under the command and leadership of Joshua, they had been in the land of Israel undisturbed for a millennium, which is a phenomenal principle. And now the Babylonians come along, they destroy the temple, and they take the Jews into exile, and it was terrible. They treated people really badly. We have some horrific accounts of things that happened at that particular time. And Ezekiel now emerges as a prophet while all of this is happening. So he's given a prophecy to address to the Jewish refugees slash prisoners who are living in Babylon. And God says, go tell them the prophecy of how to design the future temple. And Ezekiel protests. The Midrash tells us that Ezekiel protests and he says, whoa, hang on a second. This is insult to injury. Besides the fact that it's completely impractical. We're talking right now about the Jewish people exiled in Babylon. They're not even in the land of Israel. Not only are they not in the land of Israel, they have no way to return to the land of Israel because they are captives under Babylonian rule. Why, he says to God, why are you teasing them by saying that I should teach them all about the construction and design of the temple when it's something that is purely theoretical and has absolutely no bearing on their lives right now? Maybe at some point in the future, maybe when there's an opportunity, as there would be, incidentally, because the Persians eventually overran the Babylonians, and it was relatively shortly after that that the Persians allowed the Jews to return to Jerusalem and to rebuild the temple, and that was again under the leadership of Ezra and Nehemiah, and they had very little budget at the time, and it became a work in progress over many years. But the fact is, Ezekiel says, right now that's not even on the cards. So why are we doing this? Why are we teasing the Jewish people with this description and instruction around building the house of God when everybody knows that that can't happen? And the Midrash says, the Midrash is this Talmudic insight into the scriptural texts, says that God responds to Ezekiel and says something which is absolutely mind-blowing. He says, just because they cannot right now physically build my temple, and they currently are exiled, should the construction of my temple be left unattended to? Now, it's a really intriguing response. Ezekiel has a very logical argument. He says, why are you telling us to build the temple when you know that currently we can't do it? And God says, because I'm telling you, you cannot ignore, you cannot overlook the building of my temple. What is he saying? Well, if you read further and you see various commentators, for example, Maimonides, it turns out that we have a responsibility to build the temple. There are 613 mitzvahs, 248 of them are positive commandments that a Jewish person is required to do. And as we know very well, all mitzvahs, all positive commandments must be relevant at all times. Okay, when I say at all times, I don't mean at every minute of every day, obviously. You know, you don't eat matzah when it's Purim and you don't blow the shofar in the sukkah. So obviously mitzvahs have their specifically allocated times. Certain mitzvahs are circumstantial. So if a person happens to be in a scenario where they injured somebody else, then there's a mitzvah of how they pay reparations. There's no recommendation to go injure somebody so that you could fulfill that mitzvah. If, God forbid, a couple chooses to divorce, then there's a mitzvah of how the divorce process works. But again, nobody is suggesting that you raise your hand and say, we'd like to do this mitzvah. The fact is that all of these mitzvahs apply right across the span of history, meaning that divorce procedures in 2023 are halakhically identical to how divorce procedures were in the year zero. That's the point. That's what we mean when we say that a mitzvah applies right across the span of time. So the mitzvah to build a temple, Ba'asu li mikdash, God says, make a sanctuary for me. And then, of course, there's the specification of exactly where and how you build that sanctuary. That is a mitzvah that is applicable at all times. It doesn't mean it's doable at all times. Okay, so right now, it's not doable to build the temple for a variety of reasons. And yet, the mitzvah applies. That's what God is telling Ezekiel. He says, look, you have to understand that various mitzvahs operate in such a way that even if you can't do it practically now, you don't shrug your shoulders and ignore it. You do the best you can. So if you're not in a position to build the temple, then learn about building the temple, because that, God says, I will consider as if you are building the temple. That's why at this time of the year, when we're mourning the destruction of the temple, that really jumps out at us and says, well, we can do something about it. We could be learning about the temple, and that will equate, in a sense, to rebuilding the temple. That's something fascinating. And that's why we're going to talk a little bit about that today. If you have just tuned in, maybe you got a little thrown earlier because we had some technical glitches. Well, we're back up and running. This is Fresh Thinking. You're with Rabbi Shishler. We're together till the top of the hour. And you can join the conversation at any point in time. You can engage via Twitter or Facebook. That's either mine or Chai FM's. Rabbi Shish or Chai FM. Rabbi Ari Shishler on Facebook. And if you'd like to send a message directly, the SMS line is 34519, and you can message us on the Telegram app using the number 0618951019. I threw out a challenge. If you have any question or intriguing fact that you'd like to either ask or share about the Beis HaMikdash, about the temple in Jerusalem, the reason we're having this conversation today is because we're in a period known as the quote-unquote 3 weeks, a time of collective communal mourning over the destruction of the first temple by the Babylonians, the second Jewish temple in Jerusalem by the Romans. And so we've just discovered that by us learning about the temple, what it looked like, how it functioned, its structure, its dimensions, that is a means of rebuilding the temple, which is quite a fascinating thought. Because, for example, the Talmud tells us that if a person is required to bring a particular sacrifice, and everybody gets so caught up in thinking that all sacrifices in Judaism are sin offerings, which is nonsense. In fact, the sin offering is probably one of the least frequently brought offerings in the temple. There was the daily communal offering. There were oila, burnt offerings. There were shlomim, donation offerings, there's the Pesach offering, etc. It's only one brand of offering is called the Chatas offering. But let's just say that a person did something for which the Torah would require them to bring one of these sin offerings in order to excuse themselves, in order to cleanse themselves. But you can't do it today because there's no temple. So the Talmud says that if a person engages thoroughly in studying all about that particular offering, God will consider it as if you actually brought the offering. So there's this fascinating deal that Hashem has with us, that as long as we're capable of doing a particular mitzvah, we are required to do it. If we're incapable of doing that mitzvah due to no fault of our own, there's no temple, we didn't choose that, then the next best thing to do is to study intricately about that particular mitzvah, in this case bringing the offering, and Hashem will consider it as if you've brought the offering. And by extension, the same kind of thing applies, where God says this is the time of the year where we commemorate the destruction of the temple, and if you choose during this time of the year, instead of just lamenting what we've lost, to actually learn about the temple, God considers it as if we're rebuilding the temple, which is an incredible thought, really. Quite empowering and, I guess, quite challenging. And that's why I asked the question, do you have an interesting insight or a particular fact or a particular perspective about the temples? If you do, please share them with us, because I think they'll be really interesting. Here is X That Jewish Boy on Twitter, who says, interesting fact, to repair the Holy of Holies, the Kohanim entered in a special box with an opening on one side. It was lowered from the top of the building. And this was so that they would not look at the parts that weren't necessary. Okay, so let's just fill that in, because there's a really good, intriguing piece of information over here. So before we can unpack what that Jewish boy is saying on Twitter, let's just get a little bit of a sense of what the temple looked like. It's general layout was quite simple to the layout of the Mishkan, the tabernacle the Jews had in the desert, which means that it had a large outdoor area, which in the temple was called the Azara, the courtyard. In fact, the temple had more than one courtyard, and the second courtyard had divisions within it, which technically separated it into more than one courtyard as well. So there's a large area that is called the women's courtyard, which indicates that it's open to anybody, pretty much any time, as long as you're in a certain state of purity. Then there was a section called the Israelite courtyard, which was effectively for somebody who was in the process of bringing a sacrifice. That's where they would go. And then there is the courtyard of the Kohanim, and that's where all of the activities of sacrifices used to happen. Then to the west, remember the orientation of the temple is westward. That's why it's a big deal that we still have the western wall, because that would be the side that was closest to the holiest part of the temple. So if you're moving now in a westward direction, bearing in mind that the temple is built into a hill, into a mountain, and so not every section of the temple is on the same level. There were quite a number of places where you had to move through stairways in order to get from one platform to the next. So standing at the highest point of the temple was a building. The building was wider in the front and narrower in the back, front actually meaning the entrance and back actually meaning the epicenter of it all. And inside that building were two sections. One was called the Holy Section, which housed the menorah, the candelabra, the golden table that always had 12 fresh loaves of bread on it, and the incense altar, which was used for just that, for incense. And then the epicenter of the entire temple was what was called the Holy of Holies. In the first temple, it was behind a wall. In the second temple, it was behind a massive double curtain. Nobody was allowed to go inside. Certain times of the year, they would pull back the curtain so that the crowd could see what it looked like inside. But the only person who could ever enter into the Holy of Holies was the Kohen Gadol, that's the high priest. And he was only allowed to go in during service on the holiest day of the year, Yom Kippur. So that's why this comment by X That Jewish Boy on Twitter is so interesting, because obviously they had to do maintenance, whatever the maintenance was, redo the walls. They had to replaster the walls from time to time, or whatever the maintenance had to happen inside the Holy of Holies. Now you've got a problem, because nobody's allowed to go in there. And we're talking about a building that stood for four centuries, so there must have been a fair amount of maintenance required at certain points in time. So that's his anecdote that he's just shared with us, which is the way they would allow the workmen into the Holy of Holies in order to do their repair work is they had what was effectively the first kind of lift, a box that the workmen would get into. It had a pulley system where they'd be lowered down from the roof. So there was obviously a hatch in the roof that opened up. And then this box was lowered into the Holy of Holies. It was only open on one side and it kind of moved along the walls. so that the workmen, the repairmen, would only be able to see the particular patch of wall that they were repairing at any given time, and they did not really enter into the Holy of Holies. They were kind of in a cocoon, in a sense. So they were not considered to be inside the Holy of Holies, which would have been illegal for them. So that's interesting. That's really, really interesting. Okay, somebody's sent a YouTube link, which is very nice. It's not going to help us over the radio waves. And here's John Boy on Twitter who asks, will the third temple have central air because Jerusalem gets very hot? And the truth is that there's quite a fair amount of literature that says that the future temple, the temple that will be rebuilt in the Messianic age, will be quite technologically advanced. So yeah, I think certainly the indoor areas will have some kind of ventilation. I don't think it was necessarily the hottest structure because it had very high ceilings and was all made out of stone, which generally is quite cool. But I'm sure if we need air, we'll have air. What do you know about the Beis HaMikdash, about the temple? What could you share? 34519 via SMS. 0618951019 on the Telegram app. Otherwise, Twitter, Facebook, you can find us there.
This is Fresh Thinking with Rabbi Ari Shishla.
And we're talking today about the temple, the Beis HaMikdash, the first temple built by King Solomon, the second temple built by Ezra and Nehemiah. So the one that's probably the most interesting for all of us is the third temple that's going to be built by Moshiach. That's the really interesting one. So why are we talking about this? Because this is the time of the year when we're supposed to focus on the temple and we're supposed to learn things about it. Because when you learn about the temple, God considers it as if you're building the temple. So what other interesting thoughts or insights could you come up with about the temple? Well, here's something interesting. Depending on who you ask, there are different views amongst the original medieval Talmudic sages like Maimonides or Nachmanides about what exactly the purpose and centerpiece of the temple is. Very intriguing. Maimonides, and if you're familiar with the works of Maimonides, then you'll know that Maimonides typically takes a rationalist approach to things in Judaism. That's not to say that Maimonides is purely rationalist. There's a lot of mysticism in his teachings, a lot of deep philosophy, but he generally takes a rationalist approach and writes primarily from a perspective of Jewish law. He says that the epicenter, the key component of the temple, was the altar where the sacrifices took place. And the reason behind that would be because we know that that's rarely the biggest or most regular service that happened in the temple was bringing sacrifices. Every single day, temple service began with what was called the tamid, the communal daily offering. And every afternoon, just before sunset, it ended with the tamid communal offering. So those are the bookends of the experience in the temple. Add to that, every Shabbos there were additional communal offerings. Every Rosh Chodesh, the beginning of a new month, there were special offerings. Every festival had special offerings. If a person recovered from an illness, was released from prison, traveled across the desert or the sea, they would bring a Thanksgiving offering. There were special offerings that you had to bring when you came to visit the temple. There were offerings that you could pledge to give. There were offerings that were brought for sins, for guilt, for misbehaviors, for damages even to certain people. So the Rambam says, Maimonides says, look, if you look at this objectively, rationally, you can tell that a huge part of what the temple is about is bringing sacrifices. That's the one thing that we are not permitted to do outside of the temple. That's what it's all about. That's the primary theme. That's the epicenter. And this makes a practical difference, by the way, because Maimonides is of the view that one of the reasons you can't just go and rebuild the temple is because you need a prophet to identify the correct location for where the altar has to go. So let's say we got a great construction team together tomorrow and we decided to build a temple. Maimonides would say, well, you actually can't do that. You need somebody who is a qualified prophet who can then attest to how you design it, where exactly everything goes, because it has to be built relative to the altar. He even goes so far as to say that the altar that sat in the temple was a very specific location because of its historical meaning. That's the same place, he says, where Abraham took his son Isaac to slaughter him. It's the same place where Noah brought a thanksgiving offering to God after having survived the flood. It's the same place where Adam, right as he was created, brought an offering to recognize and praise God. And most intriguing, the Maimonides says that that is actually the spot on earth where Adam himself was created, because he says Adam was created from the place that would hold the key to his atonement, which is a fascinating insight. So that's one possibility, right? There's, and if we focus, as Maimonides does, on the sacrificial element of the temple, then we're saying that the purpose of the temple is to take ordinary parts of our world, animals, flour, wine, salt, which represent the animal, plant, and mineral kingdoms, and they all had to be present in every single sacrifice. And what we're doing is we're taking the ordinary world and we translate it into a spiritual experience. So from the perspective of Maimonides, the primary goal and objective of the temple is to transform our physical world to become a more spiritually oriented divine place. Nachmanides, the Ramban, has a completely different perspective. He says that the key element of the entire temple is the ark. Now, the logic behind that would be the ark is in the Holy of Holies. That's off limits to just about everybody all of the time, except for the holiest person in the nation at the holiest time of the year, the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur. So if that's the vault, you expect that the most valuable and precious part of the entire precinct is inside the vault. That's the ark. Inside the ark were the tablets that Moses had received on Mount Sinai. Parenthetically, it's just worth noting that the ark was hidden prior to the destruction of the first temple. You might have seen Raiders of the Lost Ark. That's actually the premise of the story, that we know that the ark was hidden. Now we got to go, so to speak, and find it. So the ark was completely absent in the second temple era, which might be a big issue from a Nachmanides perspective. But Nachmanides says that the key component of the temple is the ark. The ark represents the pristine word of God, etched into stone, presented by God himself in the most incredible way. This is what the temple is all about. And if we go with that perspective, then the temple is not necessarily so much about elevating and transforming our world from its mundane physical state into an elevated divine state. Rather, it's all about infusing godliness, pristine godliness, into our world. That's the purpose of the temple. Bring godliness into the world. Channel God into the world. Like you've got these stones that have this miraculously etched. Miraculous because you could read the stone from any direction. So it's got God's word etched into it. That's what brings godliness into our world. Now, generally speaking, whenever you have two divergent opinions amongst the sages or Talmudic views, or even things that appear to be contradictory in the scriptures, generally speaking, we remind ourselves of the basic principle, God is one. So conflict is imagined. If there's conflict between Torah sources, we haven't understood fully what's going on. And so Maimonides and Nachmanides are actually not debating which is the primary element of the temple. They're illustrating that there are two primary elements at work over here, because the purpose of the temple was, on the one hand, to elevate our world, and it did just that. And on the other hand, infuse godliness into our world, and it did just that. If we want to be technical, the first temple was primarily about infusing divine energy into the world. The second temple was primarily about taking the world in its raw state and elevating it to a higher purpose. The third temple that will be built by Moshiach is going to have the perfect synthesis and harmony of both of those realities, which is why the world will be in its ultimate state. Good reason why, of course, we should want the temple to be rebuilt. It generates a perfect world.
This is Fresh Thinking with Rabbi Ari Shishla.
Okay, so we've hopefully learned one or two interesting things about the Beis HaMikdash, about the temple, because this is the time of the year when we're supposed to do just that, so that we can, in a spiritual sense, rebuild the temple, and that precipitates Mashiach rebuilding the temple. Here's Yehuda on Twitter saying something actually which I had shared. I was asking for people to share interesting facts about the temple. So he says Ezra was the leader who, after the exile in Babylon, came back to Israel to rebuild the second temple. Thank you for that. It is actually something we had already mentioned. What's probably the most fascinating element about the temple is this principle. The temple is designed to, you know, it's like an embassy. You go to the American embassy on the 4th of July, the doors are going to be closed. Because an embassy behaves according to the rules of the mother country. This is God's embassy. It's a place on earth that behaves according to the rules that operate in God's realm. That's why it was a place filled with miracles, which always gets people intrigued. But it's not about the miracles. It's about the fact that it's this transformative energy. You know, the reason God created our world, we're taught, is so we could take the mundane, finite reality of our world and completely transform it so that it is no longer bound by its finite reality, but instead is able to accommodate infinite God. Now that sounds really far-fetched and difficult to do. So the temple was this tuning fork where you'd walk into the temple and you'd actually see this in action. You'd actually see physical things behaving in a way that doesn't conform to the limitations of physical things. You'd see a space, our sages tell us, that was crammed full of people. There was literally no wiggle room. Yet when it was time for everybody to bow, which would happen any time that the high priest said God's name aloud, suddenly there was enough room for everybody. Or you had this massive meat factory of all of the sacrifices and not a fly in sight anywhere. So the purpose of the temple is, it's this tuning fork. This is what the world is meant to look like. And it's not just that you go there and you get inspired and you go back to where you live and you transform your world, although that is part of it. But the ultimate objective is it was pulsating this energy into the world to shift the world from a place of conflict, from a place of mistrust, from a place of jealousy and competition and dog eats dog into a place of oneness. It's like, for example, in the laws of Shabbos, how a Jew is supposed to observe Shabbos, we speak about two possible realities. There's what is called a public domain and what is called a private domain. In Hebrew, the words sound much better. The world of conflict or the world of oneness. The temple is the place of oneness. Its job is to inspire us and to feed the world the capacity for oneness. The only reason that we would want the temple rebuilt is not because we want to be a dominant nation in the world or because we want to have a big tourist attraction, but it's because we want to have that energy of absolute oneness flowing through the veins of the world. Again, by us studying about the temple, and do yourself a favor, find out a little bit more about it, that in fact, in a sense, builds the temple, builds this world of oneness, hastens the coming of Mashiach. Please God, that should happen really, really soon. Thanks for being with me. Thanks for being part of the conversation. I want to wish you a stay warm. Have a wonderful Shabbos. It's Rosh Chodesh next week. Please God, may the new month be a month of blessing for all of us.